Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
We're here for part two.
I love it. So this is part two. I have my friend Jan Masterson here. She and I went to the University of Miami together, part of a wonderful group of friends called the Fab Five. We became friends when we were teenagers, and we are still very devoted friends to this day. Five different states. After college, we again moved to five different states, and we vacation every year together. Every other year is with our full families, and every other year, it's just us girls. And so this has been wonderful as we grow older and more wise, of course, right?
Of course.
But we started
out. I think I'm getting stupider.
We started out very wise. At least we thought we were. I mean, we named ourselves the Fab Five.
That's true. That speaks volumes
right
there.
It does. I know.
So we brought you back because I have a list of about 100 questions I didn't get to last time you were here.
All right, we were talking house museums.
Talking house museums. That you love.
Yes. Okay. Can I go into the visit to a house museum that Jan took my daughter to?
I wanted to get into that.
Okay.
But I want to finish off the museum she works at right now.
Yes. Okay.
And then I've got a stupid question, and then we'll get to good questions.
Yes. And the museum you work at right now is called?
I work at Historic Mesquite, Inc. We operate and manage the Florence Ranch Homestead and Opal Lawrence Historical Park in Mesquite, Texas, right outside of Dallas.
Okay. So one of these was a 1,000-acre working ranch with sheep and cattle and other things on it. So I asked it as a two-part question, I believe, last time. Is that one a living history site, or is it just the house? I mean, how many acres does it still have, and do you have livestock at all?
Sadly, neither of our sites are living history. We do not have the staff and resources. So the way ours is set up is that the city owns the land, the structures, and the collections.
Okay.
And then the nonprofit, Historic Mesquite, Inc., is the one that manages all of that. The Florence Ranch Homestead that had the sheep and cattle, they had hogs, the Percheron horses, is only 8 acres now.
Wow.
The family sold the land off over the years, but then also the state came in, or the county, or both, and acquired land from their original farm size to build giant highways through Dallas.
Oh,
Mesquite
nice.
Is a huge center of a whole bunch of different highways going through and around Texas.
Okay, so you've obviously experienced living history,
because
we're going to talk about a living history site. Do you think in a historic house museum without 1,000 acres around it, but 8 acres is still pretty large. Does living history add to a historic house museum experience, or does it detract from it?
That is great. If it is done well, I think it definitely adds to it. I have worked at a site that where we were trying to incorporate more living history. I think that helps bring the experience to life. One of the things that I think historic houses and historic sites can do is take people almost like a time travel experience. And I think living history especially brings that to life, especially if there's cooking going on, anything that's kind of a daily living activity, because it's in such contrast to the way we live today.
Yes. See, I've always thought just having somebody in costume doesn't really add anything to me. And I actually had as a youngster, 13 or 14, horrible experience at Colonial Williamsburg, which, you know, is supposed to be the best of the best. And it was because somebody wouldn't come out of character and answer a question. And I was old enough to know, and I can't remember the specific question, but it was something like, you know, oh, did you see that airplane fly overhead? What is an aeroplane? I was like, you're a guy that gets in a car at the end of the day. Come on. And he wouldn't answer my question. To me, that suddenly became a barrier for my learning.
Yes.
Mystic Seaport actually is one of my favorite places that I, as a kid, I was like, okay, they did what I wanted to be stepping into time. So just in a costume doesn't quite kill it for me, but in a costume and cooking and demonstrating this is how I made food in the 1700s or the 1800s and answering those questions in character, but being willing to come out of or to thread that needle. We had one of the museums I ran was 1700s, the Ethan Allen Homestead. I had a living history person that looked very young. So we had her as a colonial child and people would ask her questions, students, and, you know, do you like video games or do you like Nintendo? And she'd say, I don't know what that is, but it sounds like a game. And my favorite games are. And I love our ability there to kind of duck the question, but still answer questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think first person interpretation and third person interpretation, which you were just saying, the first person interpretation is where the character will, they will not come out of character. They will answer questions in their time frame. I think that has a time and place. I do think that, like the story you just described, it can be a barrier to learning, which is why I feel like those things work best basically as like museum theater pieces. And then you move on and then you interact with the person who is in costume, but knows that they're in the present day and is interacting with you to tie those things together like games.
So also, I assume you've gone through the Flavel House Museum here in Astoria.
Not yet.
No, it's on our agenda.
Alana, you are fired.
Remember, she got in last night.
We will have to fix
that.
So the Flavel House is an 1885-86 historic house museum. We do not do anybody in costume. We do some living history on the grounds, but not really characters, more just bring those trades and things to life a little bit. Gosh, where was I going with this? Now you distracted me by not having ever taken her through. You're like offending me now. So the Flavel House, though, has been, a lot of visitors compare it to some other historic houses in Oregon. And one of the things I always say, without trying to dish on other museums, that for me, it's not just that it's a cool house. It's that we have so much documentation about the family. Mm-hmm. And when you go through, if you watch our orientation movie, if you read even half the signage that we have, if you ask a few questions of the docents, you leave with an appreciation for how cool architecturally the house is, the time period that we're portraying, and who these Flavel people were.
Right.
And a lot of the, well, the one that people compare us to a lot, I've been there a number of times. It's a great house, but I don't get a sense of the family at all. So what, for your two homes that you do, what is the balance there of, is it about the house and the objects, the time period, or do we get to know the families and the people that work there at all?
That is something we are currently struggling with. We have had some new people come on staff who have new ideas and perspectives, which is fantastic because I feel like that is how and when interpretation can evolve at historic sites. Traditionally, I think in a lot of house museums, it is the story of the people that owned this house. Yes. And people can't connect with that. Third graders can't connect with that. That means nothing to them. They don't know these people. These people weren't famous for signing the Declaration of Independence or inventing something. Mm-hmm. They were just ranchers and farmers. Yeah. And so, yes, incorporating the architecture, I think, is very important. The Lawrence House actually is the most unique house in all of North Texas. There is not another house like it in still standing. There might have been at some point. It has these extremely unique murals, painting, I shouldn't say murals, emblems is more like what they are, painted on the ceilings of the first floor rooms. And when the city was first going into the house to do all this restoration, they weren't even aware that that was there. As I'm sure you're familiar, historic house museum decoration before the, you know, owner entity gets a hold of it has changed so many times over the decades and centuries. And so the house was just covered in wallpaper.
Oh my goodness.
Ceilings, walls, everything was covered in wallpaper, which was fashionable.
And that's actually probably great that it was encapsulating the things, but the painting behind.
Exactly. So the conservator was slowly peeling back all these layers of wallpaper. And in the downstairs parlor of the Lawrence House, uncovered these, I mean, still pristine mural, or I don't know why I keep saying murals, emblems on the ceiling. And we went to the family descendants and said, what is this? Like, what does this mean? It's so unusual. It's so unique. They didn't even know it was there because it had been covered up for so long. The family descendants weren't even aware. The last two sisters, Lawrence sisters, died in 1995. And several of their, they were two of 11 siblings. So there's a lot of descendants in the area and all throughout Texas. So there are people we can call on who went to that house as kids when the Lawrence family was still living there to say, okay, how did this work? What did this look like? But no one knew that these emblems were on the ceiling.
That's amazing.
So it's, those are the kinds of things that I do like to point out to kids because that gets their imagination going too, because we don't know what it means. Okay, what do you think it looks like?
Oh,
and then they tell me, in fact, just a month or so ago, I had a kid point something out that I had never noticed before. So the emblem is a circle. In the middle, it has kind of dash marks that go around in a circle that kind of look like a windmill. And then it has these big, huge, long lines that go out in four directions with kind of a T shape on the end. Mm-hmm. And this kid pointed out that those go in the exact cardinal directions that they're facing. Uh-huh. And I had never put that together.
Wow.
So inside your home, you know which way is north.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So I've got one more before then I want to get into the whole teaching your kids about slavery, because that is just fascinating.
And the other museum that she worked at.
But yeah, before we get to that, so you worked at the sixth floor museum.
Oh, yes. There we go.
Yes.
So I have one question, and then if you want to talk about the rest of the museum at all, but my one question, and Alana might remember where I'm going with this.
Yes.
So I visited it once.
Oh, okay.
And I was there for a conference of some kind, and I went through the museum by myself. And what I do not understand, so I'd like it explained to me, I made many enemies in line because as we were heading in, there's a metal detector.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, isn't that a little late? And nobody found that amusing around me, and I didn't filter. So why is there a metal detector? Isn't it a little late?
Yes, yes. I would say that's because of where it's positioned in downtown. There is actually not very far away. It's just on the other side of the train tracks, on the other side of the highway, is the county jail, and people escape from there occasionally. So there is a reason for that. It is also in the county building. So the county offices, the county commissioner's offices, the county judge, that's where they office. So I think that's the other reason why there's some extra precautions taken.
Yes.
I will accept my idiocy here.
But still, your comment was probably not appreciated.
We heard comments like that. Yes. Frequently. So you're not the only one.
So that is an important question. But what's the top question people ask you after working there?
Who did it?
Yeah.
So in case you're not familiar, the sixth floor museum at Dealey Plaza is in the building that was the Texas School Book Depository building in 1963, where Lee Harvey Oswald was working when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It is believed that Oswald was on the sixth floor, just thus the name of the museum, the sixth floor museum. Oswald was on the sixth floor of the museum in a corner window, had a Mannlicher Carcano rifle sticking out the window and fired multiple shots that eventually did kill President Kennedy. This is not an uncommon topic that is surrounded by conspiracy theories.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that kind of the original conspiracy theory?
Yes, yes.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
But when you're there and working there, what was your takeaway then?
I mean, honestly, I don't know who did it. I don't know that we will ever know. I think even so, the National Association for Records and Archives, NARA, which is part of the federal government, actually has in their collection all of those original interviews, documents. If anybody knows, it's in there. But I don't know that we will ever know. Maybe those documents don't even still exist. Who knows? Growing up, I always heard about the grassy knoll, because that's another one of the conspiracy theories. And then if you're ever in Dealey Plaza, the grassy knoll is like a mild rise. It's not even a hill.
So when we were in Dallas just a couple of years ago for one of our girls' trips, Jan did take us there. And my first takeaway just driving up was, this is so tiny, that space. It was just a lot smaller than I would have thought. And then also thinking that somebody could run away when everything was just right there. And now it's surrounded by freeways and highways, but it is still there. People are on the knoll, and then there is painting throughout the road there.
Yes, on the road that President Kennedy's motorcade traveled, there are two X's painted on the road by a private individual. The museum has nothing to do with that. The city or county has nothing to do with that. But that is the estimated locations of where the two shots that hit President Kennedy happened.
I just assume those were museum, because it kind of like gives you that perspective of, oh, wow, this is the distance.
And they haven't been taken away.
Well, no, they get repainted periodically. Oh, okay. Sometimes the city or county will go in and try to remove them, and then somebody goes in and repaints them. But people stand on those X's
just terrifying.
And have their pictures made. If you're not familiar with that area at all, then you wouldn't know that that is a major thoroughfare where people are flying to almost immediately get on the interstate.
Yeah.
So people will not stop for you if you are standing on the X. They will lay on their horn. They will almost run you over. I have a friend who I used to work with there. The first year she was there during the anniversary being November 22nd, the day that Kennedy was assassinated, who saw a woman put her 9-month-old baby on the X in the middle of the road. Traffic had not been stopped. The roads were not closed. And then step back on the sidewalk and take a picture. This is it's a 3-lane road at that point. The X's are in the middle lane.
That's crazy.
Also kind of a morbid shot to take. But
see, I can't quite argue with that because my favorite memories of walking through Gettysburg is with a huge Civil War Gettysburg guy. And we took pictures in places where we were basically recreating historic photos.
Oh, huh.
And then I did the same thing when I went following Billy the Kid stuff in Lincoln County. I laid on the ground where the sheriff was shot.
So you are that person.
So yeah. I would not be laying a baby, and I would not be going into it. I know that road. Yeah. I would not be stepping into that road at all.
No. So one of the cool stories I recall you sharing with us was where you traveled to another state to pick up a Lego set that recreated the scene. So tell us what you had to do.
Yeah, so when I was at the Sixth Floor Museum, a donor had contacted us, and it was a multi-year process to get this going, and that's not uncommon for museums. So he was maybe in his 30s at the time, but starting at 12 years old, he had started collecting Legos, and he became fascinated with the Kennedy assassination. And so he recreated a Lego model of downtown Dallas, the Dealey Plaza, the motorcade route, the Texas School Book Depository building, some of the other iconic buildings in that area around Dealey Plaza, all out of Legos. And he had been working on this as a child, living at home, and his mom was ready to downsize. But she knew how important this was to him. And so he contacted us and said, would you be interested? And after many, many conversations of trying to figure out, okay, are we interested? Do we want this? How would we even get this back? We did travel to his mom's house, spent 3 days, three physically exhausting days in the basement, dismantling this Lego set.
But dismantling it. So
how size? Well, give us a dimension here.
Oh, I have terrible spatial judgment, but I would say I'm trying to remember now, maybe 12 by 17 feet.
Holy moly.
It's huge. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So piece by piece, she had to take it apart. But in doing that, she also had to document how to build it.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah. It's a nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a whole process trying to figure out what we were going to do. And then we knew we couldn't put it on display immediately. That takes up so much space. We already had other exhibits planned. Our only exhibit space at the time was also our Flex event rental space and special program. So we couldn't take up the whole floor with this giant Lego thing. So it was the curator, the collections manager, and me as the cataloger who traveled up there. We had a whole assembly line system. The collections manager was taking a piece off. Well, actually, first of all, we photographed the whole thing thoroughly. I mean, every angle, every detail, overhead shots, so that we could eventually recreate this. The collections manager would take a piece off. The curator was writing a description, and then we had a little whiteboard, a small little whiteboard that we would write the accession number, the object ID for that specific piece, photograph it, and then entered it into an Excel spreadsheet that then we could go back and put all that information into our collections management database. And then once that part was done, we took the pieces back to the collections manager, and she had to very, very carefully wrap those into archival boxes with archival materials so that eventually, once it was all done, and I think it was like 30 boxes when it was all completed, were on a pallet that an art handling service came and picked up from this mom's garage.
That has to be one of the funniest, wackiest stories I've ever heard.
Yes. So, so it had dozens of the little Lego figures. And because we were trying to do the quickest descriptions ever, some of them obviously were not supposed to be specific people that we know were standing in Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination. Mm-hmm. So they were just general passersby along the motorcade. And so we came up with all these funny little nicknames of, you know, sunglasses guy, mad guy, you know, those sorts of thing. They were much funnier than that. But but we found some humor in in the exhaustion.
The worst part of having a huge Lego collection in your museum is when you're walking through the museum in the middle of the night and you're bare feet and you step on one.
Exactly.
Okay, I do want to make sure we have enough time because I was fascinated when I heard about your trip to the Hermitage and that was specific. I thought you worked there. And then just recently I found out, no, this was just your idea and you wanted to introduce Carly to mm-hmm. a very tough subject that museums have struggled with for a long, long time. So talk about why you did that and then what the message was in your interpretation of what that was all about.
Yeah, so my first museum job was actually at another historic site in Nashville that was called, at the time, the Bellmead Plantation. As many museums around the country have been re-examining themselves, that has also included changing the title of the museum. So they're now the Bellmead Historic Site. And fun little historical fact, the whole time that that place was owned by the family that had started the farm, it was never referred to as a plantation until the 1890s and only once in a letter. So the family never even referred to it as a plantation. So that kind of goes to the 19th century romanticism that is surrounded all of these plantations and all of these historic house museums. So the Hermitage is the home of President Andrew Jackson. It is an operating historic house museum. They do a little bit of living history. They don't have all of his original acreage because that was enormous, but they still do have hundreds of acres of original land.
It's huge.
Yes. In fact, just last fall, maybe they ran across an area that had not really been excavated. They had not done much archaeology and they not a lot of landscape cleanup back there, and discovered that they had a cemetery back there that was for the enslaved people. And so they've gone through the process of getting proper historical documentation of that space. But President Andrew Jackson lived during a time when slavery was still legal. And part of what happens with historic house museums, especially in the South, is that not all of the stories are told. And that is trying to change at a lot of museums, but the Hermitage still has several of the original enslaved cabins standing in their original locations on the property. And it is not an easy topic. I grew up in the South, grew up visiting Bellmead and the Hermitage on field trips as a kid, knew about slavery. These were not very, sadly to say, disturbing concepts to me because I knew of their existence. But not every kid grows up in those spaces, and slavery isn't taught in a lot of school programs anymore because they have so much material that they have to cover. I've heard that some states don't even talk about the Civil War at all because they just can't, or maybe they don't want to.
My just turned 8-year-old is brought there with Jan and myself, and ahead of time, you know, Jan and I did talk about it, and I did say that, you know, I am gonna lean towards you for this because you're gonna be able to talk to her at her level with this. And so we walk on, and at the time, it has since changed at the Hermitage. We had to pay extra for the enslaved tour. And we did. So we paid that extra amount because we wanted to add that on. The Hermitage has since changed that because we've talked about that on mm-hmm. the air. So they've taken away that barrier because that is a barrier then. Yep. So, it starts with really explaining immediately what an enslaved person is. It was very shocking. I mean, Carly is still to this day very disturbed by this. She didn't know that it existed. She didn't know people could be like this. And then there were pictures right when we walked in the first building of people that looked normal, right? They were black and they were doing those household chores and tasks. And then Jan goes into what it meant, though, to be owned. So if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's I often describe it as the way that you would own livestock if you owned a farm, because African Americans at the time were seen as a resource. They were not viewed as people most of the time. When I worked at Belle Meade, because that family and the Jackson family knew each other, so there was some common history there, we would often describe it as a patriarchal system where they should be grateful for all the things that we are providing for them. And that, I think, is one of the perspectives that so many historic sites are trying to get away from, or at least they should be.
Right.
Yes.
I think the word enslaved was pretty new, because you had said the prior time of your visit, that word wasn't being used at the Hermitage. And so when we went, that word or term was being used. And the tour guide that we had was very much explaining just what you said. Nothing here was nice. They were not treated well. There was nothing, nothing was done out of the goodness of Andrew Jackson's heart or family or anybody in his home. They lived awful existence. I mean, it was an awful life, and to work on his farm, it was terrible.
I'm curious, because I've never had to be in the sense of trying to educate a family or youngsters about this. So I'm fascinated by the metaphor of it's like livestock. How does that resonate with kids? I mean, do they get that, or are they like, well, I have a cat at home and I love my cat and my cat loves me? I mean, do they, or does it make sense to them?
I think so, because sometimes I also say it's also like the groceries in your house. You own them because they do something for you. Like you are consuming them. These people's lives were consumed by their owners. The other way it can be tied in, I think, is using some of the primary source documents and explaining that on the accounting books for the family, they listed that they had a dozen cattle and 18 bales of hay and 36 slaves. And they would list them out by their age and name. And most of these people did not have last names. That's how insignificant they were to their owners.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. But I appreciated it. And I think it was good, right? Because this was something that did exist. And it's traumatic. And it should be.
It is. Yeah, right. It is very disturbing history I think that more historic houses are trying to talk about and acknowledge.
And I applaud not just, all the museums that struggle with this, because it is a struggle. It's not an easy flipping a switch and we change our narrative. There's so many different factors involved. But I do applaud the two of you. You as a mom mm-hmm. and you as a professional that understood this was an important mission and that it's touching one young life and it's making a difference. And it's something that is not an easy subject. So when I first heard this story, I applauded both of you. And
yes.
It's kind of an amazing thing to take that extra step to try to educate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again. This was Jan Masterson, one of my best friends from college, joining us. This was part two. If you didn't listen to part one, go back on our podcast, KMUN.org or Apple or Spotify. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Go make some history. We will catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.